Participants today, we've got 26 people on the line, so that feels like a good number, and we're 2 minutes after the hour, so let's rock and roll. Josh, David, and Jeff, thank you very, very much for joining us. I think clients are going to find this very useful and informative and timely, obviously, based on all that's gone on over the last couple of weeks. We're pleased to have Dr. Jeff Curry, former commodity strategist at Goldman Sachs, and Josh Crum, CEO of AVAX, and David Greeley, also also from AVAX. David, sorry, I forgot your title. What's your title?
Chief Strategy Officer.
Chief Strategy Officer. Amazing. Awesome. Fantastic. I'd love to, so we have a variety of participants on the line. Reminder to any ATP bankers, you're not allowed to ask questions. We've also got some folks from the ATP Commodities team, the ATP FIC team, and then we have a whole bunch of folks from the ATP Equity Desk, which is fantastic. And then we have a list of clients also. So when this whole thing started, I said to you guys that, you know, like, this is a great opportunity to tell your story. And, you know, in my view, we're only at the very beginning of telling this story to a broad institutional audience. There's lots more work to do. And then obviously on your side, there's lots more work to do to build this exchange. So this is a great opportunity for our folks to learn more. And so it's also relative to, you know, the last couple months, an opportunity to buy the stock. Why don't we start off with Josh? I mean, Josh, is there sort of like a message coming out of this that you want to sort of leave investors with? And I'll ask that question first because, you know, when you're telling a story, it's good to start like with the end, i.e. the conclusion.
Sure. Thanks, Martin. And thanks, everyone, for joining today. Actually, today is a perfect day because it actually is the second birthday, the second anniversary of the launch of the exchange. We can get into more of the, you know, data, you know, of what's happened over those last 2 years. But I think what's important to understand is that we are an engineering owner-operator culture, right? And you start with, you know, what is the problem? You know, what is the purpose for our existence? And, you know, we set out 7 years ago on the exchange side of this business, you know, to build and do something that nobody else is doing in the market. And that is really about solving problems with basis risk and price discovery for many important emerging and growing commodities. So, you know, we are not here to just take market share from existing products that are already out there with a better mousetrap, but very specifically build a 1 million ADV exchange and clearinghouse for products that don't yet exist and really build it from scratch. And so we've put together, the top commodity team on the planet to do exactly that. From an investment perspective, you know, of course, you know, it all starts and ends with our clients and what we're building and the reasons that we're building for them. But from an investment perspective, this is a 1 million ADV exchange and clearinghouse. There's really only 10 to 12 of those in the world, and our view is, you know, based on at that scale, you know, we're looking at a five to $10 billion asset, you know, depending on your multiple. So we are, you know, 7 years into this journey from back of the napkin, working with original clients, having original meetings in LNG. And we're 2 years into the exchange build side of that. And, you know, we've, if you look at the history of particularly physical commodity benchmarks, there's, you know, these are built over a, over a number of years. But we are very much in the most exciting part of that growth trajectory. You know, we were at, you know, somewhere over, you know, somewhere around 1,000 ADV at the end of last year. We were at zero ADV, by the way, for the first year of the exchange after launch. We only had a block trades at that first part. We then are moving up rapidly. We're somewhere in the 18 to 19,000 ADV range as of the end of Q2 here. So we are well on our way. And, you know, we think that exchange and clearinghouses are some of the most valuable assets in the world. The second phase is about the technology. We can get into that. But you know, we're very much on a clear path right now, blocking and tackling towards our goals. Jeff, maybe hand it over to you as well, because like I said, it always starts and ends with the physical commodities and the need for what we're doing. But I think Jeff can provide a little bit more color as well, particularly with what's going on in the world today.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the most important point that really distinguishes ABAX from all of its competitors is it is both financially and physically settled. And that is very different because most of the exchanges out there take the physical settlement as given, and then they build financial products around that. Here, we're doing both at the same time. And there's three key points that this actually generates. One is it assures spot to futures convergence, which is what we call it basis risk. It makes you not dependent upon the PRAs. And then the third is it mitigates volumetric risk. So let's go back to the first one, that the convergence. This was really apparent over the course of the last 3 months since the war erupted in between the U.S., Israel, and Iran. And what we saw was basis risk blowing out across the board. It got so extreme at one point, Dated Brent was trading $149 a barrel, while ICE Brent was at 95. That type of basis risk is unacceptable. The hedges won't work for anyone trying to mitigate risk. And because we are forcing the convergence of the financial and the physical, that risk doesn't exist. And it's a huge selling point. If you look at, you know, the volumes on ABAX have increased tremendously. Part of the reasons why is people go, oh, wow, this is a really value attribute of the ABAX exchange. It doesn't exist elsewhere. And then I think the second point is that point, you're not dependent upon the PRAs. PRAs are price reporting agencies. They're like, you know, Bloomberg is one, S&P is one, and then S&P owns like Platts and Metals Bulletin and things like that. These are groups that go out and they survey the market to try to get an estimate for where the physical prices are. And then ICE and CME build exchanges and financial markets around those physical surveys. Now, the beauty of doing the financial and physical is that you actually end up with a market-based approach to getting price discovery, which is, again, a huge benefit. You can't have a couple trade houses manipulating the surveys. And then there's the issue around that we see it exactly, you know, the ability of ABAX to grow markets like LNG. It's not dependent upon where Platts and S&P are doing price reporting, but it can create market clearing in LNG in the Gulf of Mexico, Asia, and do anything across many different markets. So a lot of times the constraint on building financial markets is driven by where you can do PRAs, but by putting the two together and creating a robust marketplace, it can do both. And then the final one is the mitigating of volumetric risk. And the crisis in the Gulf was both a volumetric crisis as well as a basis risk crisis. So having the, you know, we are able to mitigate that basis risk. That's that convergence between the futures price and the spot. And then with volumetric risk, because you can take physical delivery because of the physical settlement, you can actually assure that you're going to get your supplies. Again, LNG is another one severely impacted by what happened in Qatar. So these are, I think, very significant selling points. And then the final one I want to just, you know, make here is when we're a low inventory, you know, investment constrained market like what we're seeing in commodities, the one thing that is crystal clear in a commodity super cycle is that volatility explodes. And we're seeing really high vol across all these markets. And that high volatility not only requires risk mitigation through hedging, but it also really forces players to focus on basis risk, which is that spread between spot and financial. So yeah, you know, we're in an environment that's only going to get increasingly more volatile, and which will just make Abaxx stand out among all of its peers in terms of providing a superior product. So I'm very bullish on the outlook for the demand for volume on the exchange, and when the big key point is the way this thing is actually structured.
Jeff, that's great. I want to get back to this liquidity question in a moment. First up, I want to remind participants that to ask questions, you put the questions into the chat, and then we will see them. And please fire away as we go here. But Jeff, I think it might be useful for you to take this one before we get into the liquidity provider programs. Like, talk about the people. I mean, if you know, when we took a look at that short report, I mean, one of the first very obvious questions is, why would so many people go to a firm that was doing some of the things that they claimed? So maybe talk a little bit about the strength of the team at Abaxx real quick. That's for Jennifer.
Oh, Jeff, are you connected here?
Pardon?
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Maybe you could repeat the question, Martin.
Yeah,
no problem. Jeff, real quick, I want to deal with the short report. I think the best place to start is the people at Abaxx. I mean, why would so many accomplished people go to a company that was doing the things that were claimed? So maybe talk real quick about
I get where you're going. I think the key point here is the quality of the people are being attracted by the quality of the technology that has been put together here. It distinguishes itself from any of the other peers. And when we think about the ID++. And by the way, yes, the stuff there, some of the stuff that is packaged as standard, any exchange you do it, but the core technology is far superior than any of its competitors. And that was the innovation that Josh has done from the beginning. You know, and people say, oh, I just joined. No, I've been part of this effort. In fact, I was close to Josh when he was doing the gold money effort way back when. It's not just happened out of the blue that, I joined. I don't know where this got started. I've been on the board for nearly, three years now? Yes. So it's 3 years. So it's not like it's happened. I don't know why people thought. I left Carlyle, but I didn't just join the board. I've been on the board for 3 years. And it's really driven by the superior technology. And just to understand, why am I coming here to do this? We're going to see a liquidity explosion unlike anything we have seen before. And I want to just go over the milepost of why I believe this. Is we look at Goldman Sachs, that Dave, myself, and Josh were all there during the 2000s. It got the first liquidity wave driven by Web 1.0, which is just HTML, and the Commodity Futures Exchange Modernization Act. You put those two things together, big data combined, you had Enron Online and ICE and Jay Aron, which we worked for, created a liquidity explosion that led Goldman to be called the vampire squid by the end of that decade. This one is going to be multiples of that. And think of it, just so you understand what happened in the 2000s. technology allowed you to go further downstream. So we used to trade WTI and Brent. Wow, we could start trading jet fuel, basis risk on power, basis risk in natural gas. This time it's Web 3.0, call it, I don't want to get into the words you want to call it, where you own it. You own it and you have tokens. And another important point about this technology today that Josh has created, the legal system title is inside the token. You're not trying to create legal system on the outside of the token, you're putting it into the token. So we don't have any of the other problems that other people have. What is the equivalent of the you have the Clarity Act, you have the Genius Act, like the CFMA, that's clearing the way from a legal perspective and the abilities that gets people comfortable. By the way, that CFMA litigation back in, or the laws back in 2000, all it did is killed off the incumbents. And in this case, what we're seeing is it basically clears the way that banks have to get out of the way to allow this to begin to grow in the current environment. And what do I mean by a liquidity explosion? When we were at Goldman, we could not trade plastics. Why? Because all that big data, Web 1.0, you couldn't go further enough downstream. Now, you know, whether if it's, you know, different contracts on nickel, you know, getting further downstream, we can now do that because of the technology. And the cost basis of Abaxx relative to its competitors is far superior. So the potential explosion this decade is going to make those 2000s look like a walk in the park. Anyway, you know, Martin, I know I'm rambling on here, but you know, when I hear these accusations and about the quality of the people, everybody that's here, I think it's tremendous that we're attracted to this opportunity. And then, you know, I also just want to put, you know, make it, you know, for the record, is I'm buying the shares. We're not selling into this. How can you accuse us of doing this stuff when we're buying? I've been buying all the way through this. If we were doing a pump and dump, wouldn't we be selling? We're buying. Anyway, Martin, that's my two cents on this, but I think the opportunity set here is tremendous.
Amazing. Josh, do you want to chime in on just the strength of the team real quick?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, you usually only see myself and maybe, you know, Dave and Joe on most of the calls. But the depth of our team, you know, starting with Nancy Hsia's leadership of Abaxx Singapore, you know, Nancy is just a world-class professional. You know, Jeff's worked with her for decades. You know, she essentially came to Goldman after BP to build the Chinese and Indian markets as co-head of commodities for JRN in Asia. You know, very tight relationships in China, and you're going to see a wave. You know, we saw the first Chinese FCM announced this week, and again, this is going to be a very important part of our business, is sitting as that bridge. Right now, all the major commodity exchanges are either a U.S. company or a Chinese company, including the London Metals Exchange, right? And then in this world, having a neutral, you know, like I like to say, native North American company, but out of Canada, not the U.S., and a native Chinese company, but in Singapore, not in China, is going to be incredibly important for the commodity neutrality of what an exchange does. And then, you know, I think there's going to be questions about our liquidity programs. Just want you to understand who's building that. So Russ Robinson came over from leading the Dubai Mercantile Exchange. I think it's actually now called the Gulf Merc. And that's the Omani crude contract. So he was involved when he was at ICE in designing the Murban crude contract and then leading the Omani crude contract. These are two of the most important physical markets for oil. And he's the one actually managing this liquidity program. You know, with decades of experience in the commodity exchange business. And he joined us because we're the only company in the world innovating in physical commodities. There was no other reason for him to join, but to build that market. I mean, we can go down the list. Obviously, Dave Greeley, who's here. We've just hired another former Goldman head of metals, actually had the seat before I did, James Gutman, who's going to be leading research. Dan McElduff and Joe Rea, who people know, launched ClearPoint. report. So again, it's just all the way down the list. We put together, a very strong, commodity team. Again, we all have an owner operator mentality. I own over 10% of the company. And like Jeff, have been buying shares at every price level, including, before and after the report. And our entire board and management, including, obviously Robert Friedland and the early investor, I think, we're around 20% of the ownership of the company. Obviously a legendary commodity team with significant skin in the game here.
Great. So we're getting a number of questions in the questions box here. So I'll start hitting those in a moment. One more for me, though. Like the second big question that I think is obvious to ask when you see a report like this is, they're basically claiming that the MSA is asleep at the wheel. Can you talk about how unlikely that would be? And then just in general, like what your relationship with the Singapore authority is?
Dave, you want to start there and then I can add some?
Yeah, sure. I think that's one of the frustrating points is we're operating a highly regulated exchange and clearinghouse in Singapore. We chose Singapore because of the very high standards that they have as a regulator, the Monetary Authority of Singapore, well respected globally. It's the respect that other regulators have for them that, help facilitate us being recognized as a foreign board of trade in the United States by the CFTC so that people can trade directly on our central limit order book, the electronic screens in the U.S. because of the respect that the CFTC has for the Monetary Authority of Singapore and for the controls and principles and regulations that are in place. So, like any regulated entity, we're in continual dialogue with them. We reached out proactively regarding this report, in particular, because it really crossed the line of going to our clearing members, which are vital parts of the ecosystem, and our brokers, and trying to undermine confidence in our markets, along with confidence in our share price. And so, we've reached out to regulators both in Singapore as well as in Canada. And we're in constant touch. We have to, we have all the regulatory filings, all the data filings that go to the MAS for review. And, it's business as usual.
What has been the response and reaction from some of the market participants?
I would say almost universally, they see it for what it is, right? If you look at, the folks that run clearing firms, brokers, they're highly sophisticated financial players, right? They're trading in these markets every day. They've been around for decades. They know these tricks. They know these people. And so they haven't really given it any attention. There is a certain level of confidence that a new market needs. So we have to take it very seriously. We don't want them undermining confidence in our markets.
Yeah, this is the equivalent of reaching out to major bank customers and, yelling bank run or something, right? That they're trying to kill the exchange before it starts. Again, the sophistication of the MAS and our clearing members it's very easy to see in the data. And everyone's been in of these, clearing members have been involved in building new markets and know exactly how it works.
Awesome. A general theme in the question list here is the liquidity provider programs and open interest. So let's start with liquidity provider programs first. And what are they? Why do you use them? And in the end of the day, how can investors distinguish between real and other volume?
Yeah, so maybe I'll let Dave, I mean, Dave did a fantastic job laying this out in our end of, year-end conference call. I think that was around April. So I'd encourage anyone to watch that. And we went through this in detail. But Dave, do you want to speak specifically about the liquidity programs?
Sure. First, I would say all the positions are real positions. You have to be really careful with that language, right? Anybody putting a position on is subject to real risk that that position can move against them, and they could suffer losses, financial losses. They could potentially need to go to delivery. So these are all real positions. Now, in terms of the incentive programs, every exchange and every new market needs to use incentive programs to build the initial liquidity that's necessary for commercials and other hedgers and participants to participate in the marketplace, right? One of the interesting things, and we've always appreciated, Martin, you helping, you know, to educate your clients on how exchanges work, is that if you think about a marketplace becomes more valuable to each user the more users are using it, right? And so in the beginning, that's a challenge because are you going to trade in a market where no one else is trading? No. Similar to, you know, with a lot of tech companies like we've seen, like Uber or Facebook, you know, no one's going to drive for Uber if no one's downloaded the app, and no one's going to download the app if no one's driving. So the first thing you need to do in a market, you know, no one's going to trade a market if no one else is there. So in terms of the incentive programs, I think sometimes the name is unfortunate, because people think it's, you know, like just free money. You know, the individual programs are market maker programs, which it's in the name. You know, you're making a market. So market makers stand, they post bids and offers that they will trade at. And so someone else can come into the market, they can see the bid, they can see the offer, and they can trade. That's a risky position to be in. It might be, and sometimes it's costly. So in the gold market, where there are other gold markets like the COMEX, the market maker might need to lay off some of that risk of the bids and asks they're posting by taking a position in a related market like COMEX. Now they're going to have to post margin there. They're going to have to pay fees. So it's not free for them. At the same time, you know, if it's an LNG market, part of why we created the LNG market is that there's not a good reference for what's the price of LNG, as Joe Rea has said for the past, you know, 5 years. So, you know, they're trying to start that price discovery. So we have market makers who post bids and asks, and they're, you know, they stand ready to trade at those. They're members of a market maker program. There are liquidity providers. So there are liquidity providers who get compensated based on overall trading activity. You know, and why do you need that? Well, you need people in the market trading so someone else can put on a position and, most importantly, take off a position. That's what most people are worried about. It's not getting in. It's the ability to close a position when you need to. And so, you know, a lot of those types of programs, the liquidity provider programs, there's a number of aspects on, you know, it's multidimensional. It's not just the more volume, the more you get. It's often a pool structure. So participants are competing for a pool that grows with the total amount of participants meeting the criteria. And those criteria aren't just volume. They can be open interest. They can be depth of the order book. They can be continuity of being in the market. So it's not just coming in and out, but being a more stable presence. The most important thing is that all of these are geared to overcoming that cold start program and creating the conditions that are necessary for others to come in and trade. And that's, you know, what we're trying to do is drive up that S curve. There's the old market saying that liquidity begets liquidity. And eventually, you know, that liquidity becomes our moat. In the beginning, it's the challenge that needs to be overcome. And that's why we, like every other exchange, uses these types of programs in the beginning.
Yeah, I just had a couple quick things. One, of course, none of this has, you know, none of this is being done for investors. This is being done for the quality of our liquidity. There's actually six different metrics in our market maker and liquidity prior program. And it's really about, as Dave said, it's not about getting into trades, it's about getting out of trades. You want to make sure you've got, you know, market depth, bid and offer spreads, you know, throughout the trading day that are consistent. You know, obviously enough volume. So volumes, you know, give you one of the metrics for the trading and taking commercial positions. And so again, this is, you know, very standard blocking and tackling, you know, market making. You know, Dave referenced Uber. This is, you know, obviously a much, much, you know, cheaper, you know, market build than paying, you know, paying cars to drive around all day to make sure that the spread, remember what was the key cold start they had to solve? When someone opened the app, they needed to have a car within 5 minutes of pressing the button. That's a spread. And that was a very, very expensive spread to make. But that's a, you know, by you know, having those programs, that's the liquidity flywheel. And again, like, you know, I'm sure you'll get into more questions, but we've got a top line revenue. We've got a bottom line, you know, sort of, you know, cash outlay that we've been spending all year. That's been very consistent for the entire, you know, sort of 5 years of being a company. It's not increasing significantly now. And we've got at least 5 quarters to keep growing our markets at the exponential rate that we have been over the last, you know, 5 quarters without increasing our total cash spend. So, you know, again, there's the top line, there's the programs, there's the trading, there's everything that happens in between, and there's a bottom line. And the bottom line is that we have over 5 quarters to keep growing these markets exponentially.
I'm going to keep going with some client questions. Is it possible to give investors the percentage of volume that is being incentivized?
Look, we're obviously going through a lot of that with our financial department in, you know, in light of these reports and the questions from investors. So, you know, again, it's disclosed in our, you know, as you know, bundled in one of our, you know, our key marketing expense line. We're going to look at how we present that in the financials going forward. But again, I think, you know, starting at the top and the bottom line, you know, that's the key here. And the other key is, commercials have been involved for 7 years in this business. You know, whether they're ready, you know, to take, make or take liquidity, you know, really has to do with their commercial objectives, their onboarding, their connectivity through their you know, interdealer brokers that are going to be, you know, matching physical block trades, their ISVs, their data providers, all of the data that they have to run their time series on to be, you know, confident in our market. There's a lot of pieces of infrastructure still being built for more commercial liquidity. But again, commercials do, you know, a trader and a trader P&L is as time focused as it gets in all of markets. You know, they haven't spent 7 years for us, you know, building our products and calling their FCMs to connect because they don't want to trade the market. You know, there's been a significant investment from commercials to get in here. But we can't shortcut getting the liquidity and the you know, and the time series of our data that they're going to need to trade at bigger volumes.
Yeah, and I would say it's safe to say, Martin, that most of the volume is coming from participants in the programs. But that, you know, the way the programs are structured, it's not that they're getting paid for each trade. You know, so there's a difference between, you know, who's a participant in the program versus who's, you know, versus why a particular trade occurred. So, you know, when you look at it overall, what we're seeing is even the participation, you know, the trading from the participants has been growing. Some participants are losing money. Some participants are making money. And as that participation grows, as even they become used to the market and with more people participating, it's de-risking it for them, then we're seeing more commercials begin to come in, and it varies market by market. I know people have been very focused on OI. I'd say look at our Corsia phase one carbon emissions unit market. That's one where you say open interest quite comparable to the amount of volume trading. And you're seeing, you know, in there, while volumes are still at the beginning phase, you are seeing what looks to be, you know, more organic participation.
Yeah, and actually, that's a very important point. People like to sort of abstract and grow it, you know, show the overall numbers. But really, you know, these markets, you know, live or die, win or lose, product by product. So you really need to look at the need for the product, the types of participants in each product, and again the path towards gross margin on a product by product basis. That's the way our team and our sales looks at it, and some are at different stages, right? It's so much easier to launch a gold or silver product when there's very liquid markets elsewhere to sort of manage risk against, lay off basis risk, in other markets. It's very difficult for something like LNG. And then there's some markets like carbon, which are very advanced our exchange, but they're just not huge volume businesses, right? So product by product is always the way to do this. It's why we build them. Again, none of these are built in a vacuum. They're built with commercial participants. And look, remember, we built this entire company for on the exchange side of things for less than $100 million. Even some of the sort of startup stock exchanges have raised like $250 million. Like, we are still in our early, very capital efficient part of our program, and we don't have the time to focus on products that doesn't have that commercial demand and know where it's headed.
That's great. Should investors look at open interest as a measure of traction?
David's favorite question.
No, I was. We want to take everything seriously, but I was joking that I've heard more about open interest in the past 2 weeks than in 25 years in commodities. Yes, sure. You should look at open interest. You should look at a lot of things, right? Like, this is a multi-dimensional build. If it was a simple formula, then anyone would do this, right? There's a reason why there's so few exchanges and clearinghouses being built, why there's so little innovation in the industry, because it's hard and it's multidimensional and it takes people with a wide variety of skill sets that you see in our team. So while I look at open interest, right? Open interest is just positions that are left open, from day to day. And so that, people look at it as a rough proxy for, hey, are you having commercial traders in your market? Are you having hedgers? Are you having more of that organic growth? And that's one indication of it. We would say also look at other indications, because many of the criticisms that we've been given over the past few weeks are really criticisms you would have of any new market, and especially any new market with a new clearinghouse. So what are some of the other indications you can look at? Well, what are the most sophisticated market participants doing, right? Are they continuing to onboard? Are they continuing to look for growth in the exchange? And that's what we're seeing. So while we've done a lot of work on connectivity over the past several years, we just announced our, first China-related clearing member joined earlier this week. We saw our prices are now available on LSIG, which is like the old Reuters Refinitiv, or the latest version of that. So we continue to see clients want to onboard. We continue to see clearing firms come on. We continue to see ISVs. And those people aren't doing it because they don't believe there won't be a market there, right? It's like it costs them time. It costs them money to connect with our exchange. They're only going to do that because they see the potential. And I think that, along with OI, is worth looking at.
Okay, let's talk about basis risk. And I hate to badger on the same point here, but so since the war in Iran started, volumes have moved up in several contracts on ABAX. How much of it is people attracted to the exchange to reduce the basis risk that we've talked about before?
Well, I think this is increasingly in precious metals, like our silver contract. I think we talked a lot about on the last call you hosted. This is a very unique position for us. It's a 4.9 silver contract. COMEX is 3.9s. It's not industrial grade. So the silver contract on COMEX, one, it's in the U.S. It's U.S. warehouse or vaulted silver. So you've got potential tariff risk on that metal in the ongoing geopolitical situation, and it has to be refined, or, you know, usually in Switzerland before being used in industry. So when you get a silver squeeze, it's actually usually the refining bottleneck, going from a 3.9 silver bar on an exchange to get it into the actual supply chain, mostly in Asia, for electronics and photovoltaics and all of the various use cases for industrial silver. And then on the other side of things, you have the silver markets in China, and China has increased their export restrictions of a number of critical minerals as their main lever in this ongoing geopolitical situation. So here we are in Singapore with a 4.9 industrial silver that doesn't have the basis risk not being able to export out of China, or potentially getting a tariff hit on your position in the U.S., which created all sorts of chaos and volatility for a lot of the metals. That's just a perfect example of why does the world need another silver contract? It's for these sorts of specific risks. That's just one of many benchmarks that we think, being in a neutral place, the center of the gravity of the physical commodity trade in Asia, but having sort of open Western financial system connectivity and U.S. trading is going to be a very valuable contract.
Can you give investors a general sense of rebates per contract?
Yeah, it's not structured as a rebate. Our incentive programs, largely the liquidity provider programs, are, not to go too deep into it, but they're more of a pool structure, and the entire pool of an incentive that's available depends on how much overall trading occurs in the market, and then participants in the program compete for that pool based on how they meet the various dimensions that have been set for it. So it's not a dollar per trade figure that a rebate would be that we could give. But if you do look at our financial reports, I believe in our latest disclosure, we had about 1.7 Canadian was spent in the quarter on those programs.
Awesome. It's probably worth educating folks on the nature of the pool. I'm glad you brought that up. And is there anything more to say there, or that's a pretty good description?
Well, like I said, there's six different metrics they're competing against, and volume's not the only one, right? It's keeping spreads within a range throughout the day, and so. Like the way these are built are that, there's risk and reward, right? And your cost per trade is only one piece of the equation, right? But I've got my algorithm. I know my arbitrage against other markets. I can look at my spreads and, time spreads. And I've just taken one little piece of the risk bucket off. Which is, if I hit this metric in my algo, the cost side of it is reduced. Right. So again, these aren't, it's not a direct rebate. It's not paying to trade. It's just creating the pools that so people can run their algos on their risk reward calculations.
Yeah, and I would add, just because I think it's helpful for people to understand what we can or can't do. These are pools that the participants are competing for. The size of the prize tends to increase with, how many members of the pool are meeting the metrics. And as Josh said, that's six dimensions, something like that. But also they tend to be monthly. So it's not that we're dialing up and dialing down volume. We don't control the outcome, to put it, concisely. What we're trying to do is set conditions that will create the type of trading and liquidity that's necessary for other participants to come into the market. So what do other participants want to look for? Well, mainly they want to know that they can get into a trade and they can get out of a trade. So they want to see consistent volume. They want to see reasonably narrow bid-ask spreads. They want to see some open interest, so they have some confidence that the the volume will be there in the future. They want to, you know, see that during stressful periods, the volume doesn't go away on them. So there's a number of, you know, things that just people can think about themselves. What would it take for you to come into a new market and to take that risk? So the program's really about that. We're trying to set those conditions, and we do adjust and tweak the programs because you set the program up, you see how the market responds to it. If it's turning, you know, if it's creating the conditions you need, great. If it's not, then you tweak the program. You know, if the bid-ask spreads are too wide or open interest is too low. And so often that takes a couple months to play out and see. But that's what we're doing currently.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think one of the things that we found most frustrating is with the report and why it got any airtime whatsoever is just how little it understands about our actual business. And that's why we wanted to spend this time explaining in the weeds as far as deep as people want to go. Because again, a central low middle order book trade has nothing to do with the exchange. The exchange can't create those trades. That's a third party ISV with their own, you know, market surveillance. That's a third party clearing member that it's going through with their market surveillance. We don't have an input on what's happening on the exchange. It's third party traders with third party ISVs and clearing members. So as Dave said, you set the initial conditions before the beginning of the month on the pools, and there's an emergent outcome as people, like I said, dial up their risk and reward. This day I lost money, this day I gained money. And that emergent outcome is just part of the metrics to get people trading. But there's nothing we can do on a linear basis to say, hey, we want this kind of volume. That just doesn't work in our markets.
Oh, sorry, Martin, I can't hear you.
Oh, really? How about now?
Yeah,
that was fine.
Good.
Well, clear the air questions real quick. Does Kilo Capital represent a large percentage of trading?
Zero.
No.
0% of trading.
They've been involved in some of our initial trades, because what we also show is, right, there's the daily trading. And then what a lot of commercials also need to do is have confidence that our system works, in particular, being able to go to delivery and be the first person to do a block trade in a market. So Kilo has been involved in some of those, as you know, you would want someone help.
Yeah,
but they're not involved in any of the market maker or liquidity programs. They're not involved in any of those.
Why would the CBOE walk away from their investment?
They did not walk away. We bid them out of it strategically. So it wasn't a significant investment. We covered it on the Thursday call. But they did have some restrictive rights on us. It was a very small amount of money. We were a partner that, you know, planned to do a lot of things in equity markets as well, their global listing platform and so forth. But they had I think we dealt with like 14 people during that investment. And I think 13 were like let go after the management change. So nobody that we were working with originally when we listed on the NEO and then CBO Canada were involved in the company anymore. We were sitting there with some restrictive rights. So we bid them out, we basically did a deal where people could either invest more, like a rights offering, into the subsidiary, or they could, be purchased out. So we gave people two-way, you know, sort of option, and CBO chose to exit at a profit. But I should say this is very important that it was actually a NAV accretive to us, right? So based on both of our last two financings and the implied valuation of the exchange, this was more than 2x NAV accretive for what we actually bid them in the private subsidiary. So this was good for shareholders on many many levels, but they never asked for liquidity. We bid them out.
And I think it's probably worthwhile, Martin, also spending an extra moment, because I think it's often confusing in that, you know, there were some investors in the subsidiary of Abex Singapore, and then there's investing in the parent company, which is the listed Abex Technologies. And the reason the corporate structure was set up there originally was the idea that people might want to invest in the clearinghouse. We saw how valuable that was in an asset and thought people might want to invest directly into that piece rather than into the broad company as a whole. As we talk about liquidity a lot on this call, I think what we discovered over time was that more investors were interested in just investing at the parent company level because it was publicly listed and more liquid. And so, you know, what we've seen more of the investment at that level. But sometimes people get confused between the two, and there were investments directly in the subsidiary and then in the parent company. So
there was another claim that you guys sort of turned on the taps when you're giving a demo. Do you guys want to talk about that?
Yeah, I've already explained that it's basically impossible to do that in a cleared market. That just, you know.
And also it's important to say, like, if that was turning on the taps, it was the dumbest thing anyone could have ever have done, in that it was an LNG forum. So it was an LNG forum being conducted under Chatham House rules with participants in the LNG market to help them understand our contracts, get real feedback, and, you know, try to generate that commercial interest. So just part of our general commercial strategy. So why you would show activity in a silver contract at an LNG forum, you know, is a little bit incredulous on its surface. One of the participants there was Trayport, which has been a great addition for us as an ISV. Many traders in Europe use that platform for accessing exchanges like our own. In a networking room at the event, they were demonstrating their system. The way, you know, if anyone goes to any commodity conference, you'll see the ISVs demonstrating their platforms and showing their screens. And because it was attached to an ABEX event, they showed an ABEX screen. You know, coincidentally, there was a decent amount of silver trading occurring at that time. But it wasn't part of our presentation. Like, it wasn't part of what Joe was discussing on the stage, because that was about LNG. It was not about silver.
It was for humoring me with those ones. Okay, so we're kind of running up on time here. We've hit most of the questions I see. One that I'd like you guys to talk a little bit about, it's sort of a new topic, but perps. So there's been a lot about perpetual futures in the news lately. Can you maybe just talk about them and you know, like, what you think it implies for your business and what distinguishes what you guys do relative to perps?
Yeah, so I'm actually back in DC today. We've actually spent a lot of time talking about perps, and that's been a big focus of it's a leveraged spot market, vehicle in something with continuous spot markets like crypto, because, you know, it's abstract. It's not a real thing. It doesn't really have any real costs. You can run a spot perp or a spot, you know, like the swap type product, all you want and, you know, generate, you know, retail type interest. If I'm delivering a cargo of LNG in October, a daily spot leverage product does absolutely nothing for my hedging risk, right? You know, people, you know, in commodities, you need curves. Curves are not predictions of the future. They're delivering a commodity at a specific time and location. And so that does not work in a perp whatsoever. No one's going to be doing a daily roll on, you know, trying to place an LNG trade in October. Right. So it doesn't really affect the markets that we're doing. We are not a retail market. We're an institutional market. Perps are very specifically a retail product. So there may be parts of the, you know, the mini, you know, the sort of retail leverage product books at some of these exchanges, but that doesn't exist at ours. So it's just not, it's not really relevant to what we do.
Yeah, I would just add, the perpetual and perpetual futures means it never goes to delivery. You know, the entire commercial need we saw for our exchange was from commercial players who need to make and take delivery of commodities that they're in those markets every day. So, you know, for them, having an instrument that never goes to delivery, that's not the market we're trying to address. Going to delivery, having that convergence of the financial to the physical that Jeff talked about is very important. And being able to, you know, buy and sell a commodity for a specific date at a specific place is what our customer base is looking for. It's institutional, it's not retail. And I would just like to say, just quickly, I think Josh might have, you know, said something about, you know, the people at SIBO being let go. We would just want to say, you know, people take whatever we say out of context, or some people do. I think, you know, probably more closely, it would be many of those people have left.
Yep. Yeah, on the PERP thing as well, I mean, I just, and this is one of the conversations I had with the Senate Agriculture Committee, is that I'm imagining the type of chaos that would have happened when oil went negative during COVID if you consolidated all of your front month liquidity into next day open interest, right? So it was a retail, it was likely retail products in the ETF space that drove oil so deeply negative to begin with, because, you know, they went long on a retail product that they couldn't take delivery and they couldn't get out of the trade. So if we now hyper consolidated that into a hyper liquid next day delivery in a perpetual, oil would have been absolute chaos in that market. So we think these are dangerous products and commodities.
Interesting. Okay, thank you guys very much. We're coming up on the hour here. I want to get Jeff back in here for just one more. So yeah, Jeff, we've had a lot of volatility of late in some very important commodities, especially to Canadian investors, you know, like important metals and energy. Any thoughts about like where we are here, and should investors be like dipping its toe into some of these commodities and related stocks?
Absolutely. When we look at oil, I want to emphasize, it's in a surplus right now because you just like, it's like popping a pimple. You took everything out of that Gulf that was trapped and pushed it out into the system all at once. And they've been doing it even before the ceasefire. So 3 to 4 weeks of that rush coming into the system. It's putting downward pressure on spot crude, but refining margins are near record. They're at record levels on a percentage basis, which is telling you, you still have a shortage at the refined level. But also after that pimple pop, you know, goes through the system, then we're going to start to equilibrate, and you got to rebuild inventories around the world, strategic reserves, commercial reserves. Remember, we drained over $1.5 billion. You got to use a lot of that to rebuild those reserves. And then demand's continuing to grow. The one caution I have about crude is the market's trading like we're out of refining capacity. Record refining margins, crude prices weak, and contango on the front ends. And I think part of that is we've seen the Ukrainians take out Russian refining capacity. The Gulf refining capacity is still shut in somewhat. And, you know, the Chinese have been offline. So I think, you know, there is that one caveat. So you need those refineries back up and running. And then finally, when we think, you know, so do I view this as a buying opportunity? Absolutely, yes. So I think we're almost 69 handle on Brent. That's lower than what it was before the war started. And so I'm optimistic that, you end up with a much more positive, you know, you're probably not going back to 100 plus, providing the hostility stay low, but you should be in that 80, 85 range, which is where the cost basis of the industry is. On the metals, entry point at any point in time, you know, like the copper is the new oil, that's where the real upside is. So I'd be very positive there as well. Gold, I want to run the course through this interest rate cycle before I jump in there, because it's, you know, that's mainly down because of the rate hikes. But, you know, there's a buying opportunity on gold, you know, the next couple of months, I'd argue. I like metals and I like oil.
Industrial metals, pretty interesting here.
Yeah, I look at, you know, copper, it's retraced back to the close to the lower end of 13,000. We're at 14,000 at the beginning of the war. And we have, you know, the manufacturing rebound, you're probably going to see also is you have, you know, some access to more supplies that were not in the that were trapped in the Gulf would reinforce the upside there. So I'm very positive on copper. You know, I think easily get back up to 15,000.
Gents, you know, I think I speak for the clients when say thank you very much for giving folks this opportunity. And we're at the hour here, so why don't we let Josh have the last word? I mean, Josh, like, what should what should investors expect from ABAX, you know, from here?
Nonlinear positive growth. I mean, everything you want. I mean, look, the company on our target to 1 million ADV, $5 to $6 billion market cap, which would be implied in sort of $5 to $10 billion market cap, depending on your multiples or pulls of what's implied in that. We're 2 years into a, you know, at least decline long journey, but we've you know, never had better funding. You know, it's important to not just look at where we are today, but look at where we're going to be, you know, 4 to 6 quarters from now, the current, you know, balance sheet that we have. And if you look back 4 to 6 quarters, we had no volume on exchange. We didn't have a Chinese FCM onboarded, which we've just announced. We had no data providers. Our technology pilots weren't done. And we're going to spend a lot of time on technology in the second half of this year. That's the whole second half of the story we haven't even got to in the hour of this call, right? So look, I mean, we have never had a better business momentum and fundamental momentum. I think our press releases, even this week, were some of the best we've had all year. And we're going to have, you know, more of that, you know, coming over the next, you know, over the next 6 quarters. So, you know, longest runway, yet I think, you know, we might be at a low point in the share price this year. So, you know, a lot of fear and uncertainty brought into market by a report that, you know, clearly doesn't understand our industry or our team, all questions they could have asked us before they put it out. And, you know, because we're obviously extremely open on every forum, so, you know, we just see this as the best opportunity for investors yet.
Okay, super. We'll look forward to look forward to taking the next step of the journey here, really appreciate you guys make yourselves available. That's great.
Sounds
thanks,
good.
Thanks,
Martin.
Thank you, Martin.
Thank you. ADB.